Welcome to Wine About History. I'm your host, Max Hamill, and with me as always is Patty. And today we have a wonderful guest, Deirdre Marie Capone.
Hi, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Max. Pleasure to meet you.
Excited to meet you. So this is the second guest we've had on, and we're talking about her book and the untold story from inside his family, Uncle Al Capone. And it's, I read tons of history books for this show, and I read tons of gangster biographies and autobiographies. This is my favorite, and I have to keep buying copies because I kept giving them away, and people wouldn't give them back.
Well, it was very difficult to write the book, I will tell you that. It was very painful for me to grow up in the city of Chicago with the last name Capone. It was, you know, just horrible. Al Capone died on my 7th birthday. And so, you know, my family needed something joyous to look forward to. And so Mother's Day was coming up. And of course, I'm a Catholic, and Catholics make their first communion when they're in second grade. So they thought, okay, well, the whole family will go to church and watch Deirdre make her first communion. And the Capones outfitted me and got me patent leather shoes, which the nuns yelled at me for, and, you know, had purse and, you know, the veil and everything else. And so the whole family showed up to watch me make my first communion. And then afterwards, we all went back to the Capone house and had a big picnic. Because back in those days, the communion was always held on Mother's Day. And this would be the first Mother's Day that Al's mother, my Grandma Sita, didn't have with her beloved Al Capone. So we decided that we would all go there and have a celebration. Well, this is in 1947, so if you are good with math, you'll find out right now I'm 80 years old, right? So this was in 1947, and back then, the Chicago papers had local editions that would always come out on Monday. And there were two local editions of the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago American that came out on Monday. And it had the statement that the children at St. Philip Neri School made their first communion. And Deirdre Capone, with the entire Capone family in attendance, made hers. Well, my dad tried to protect me when he entered me in school. And he used his middle name as though it were my last name. So the priests and the nuns knew who I was, but the students didn't, and their parents didn't. So I entered school as Deirdre Marie Gabriel, because my father was Ralph Gabriel Capone. Well, they ran the story, and this Deirdre Capone with the entire Capone family in attendance. Well, how many Deirdres do you think were in that school, let alone the city of Chicago in 1947? So I was outed. When Al Capone died, all the papers all over the world ran all these alleged things that the Capone family did. And of course, my classmates' parents are reading all these allegations for the very first time, because they didn't read it, you know, back in the 20s and 30s. So they were reading it now. And of course, people accept if you read it, it has to be the truth. So, you know, 2 weeks later, every boy and every girl in my second grade class was invited to this girl's birthday party, but not me. They wouldn't come to a birthday party if I had it. You know, nobody was allowed to play with me. Nobody could have anything to do with me. And I tell a story in my book that a new girl came to St. Philip Neri when we were in sixth grade, and I just glommed onto her and said, be my friend, because she didn't know who I was. So it was very difficult for me to grow up in the city of Chicago. So when my husband and I got married, and he had a chance to start a business up in Minnesota, we moved up there, and no one up there knew who I was. And so my wings literally spread, and I've done pretty amazing things for a woman my age. But when I did that, I didn't tell our children their heritage, because I didn't want them to go through anything. I mean, there was a part of my life where I hated God for making me a Capone. It was just horrible. So I didn't tell them. And one day our one son came home from school and he was about 11 years old at this time, 12, I guess. And I said, hey, Bob, what did you learn in school today? And he says, well, we're studying about this gangster called Al Capone. And it was like somebody took a baseball bat and hit me in the stomach with it, you know, and I just said, oh. So I went in my husband's office and I said, honey, we're going to have to tell the kids their heritage, you know, until I just didn't want them to find out from somebody else. So it took all my courage. And my husband and I called all four kids into the kitchen at the kitchen table. And I'm sitting there and my husband's holding my hand and I'm looking at them. I think they thought somebody died, you know, or I was going to tell them something. And I said, kids, I've got something to tell you. I said, I was born Deirdre Marie Capone. Al Capone is my uncle. And the four, and this is the honest to God truth. The four children looked at me, then they looked at each other. And the four of them in unison looked back at me and went, cool, Mom. Well, I wasn't expecting that response. And I thought they were going to hate me because now they had gangster blood in their veins, because that's how I was conditioned to believe that was all I could ever be, you know? So they started peppering me with questions and I got out the family albums. And then I started to take, my husband and I took them on road trips. And we went back to Chicago, introduced them to everybody, went up to my grandfather's place in Mercer, Wisconsin, introduced them to everybody up there. So that my family, you know, would reacquaint themselves with me, because I really avoided them. You know, I just, you know, my husband didn't want any connection with them because he didn't want anybody to think that, you know what, he was being part of the mob. So it was a reunion. But, you know, the kids started to ask me things and they begged me to write a book. And, you know, I talked to people and, you know, they say something about Al Capone and they say, oh, I know everything about Al Capone. I said, oh, really? What do you know? Well, he died of syphilis. No, he didn't. He died in prison. No, he did not. He committed the Valentine's Day massacre. No, he did not. You know, I mean, every single thing, you know, is wrong. So anyway, I decided to write a book. And since I wrote the book, the Chicago Bar Association in the city of Chicago 2 years ago held a trial and they tried Al Capone for murder in the Valentine's Day massacre. Now, the trial for income tax evasion was a retrial because he was tried for income tax evasion, but he was never, you know, accused of any murder ever, especially the Valentine's Day massacre. So what they did is they decided to try Al Capone for murder. They had a real judge, real jury, real witnesses, and they went through, he was acquitted. They could not find enough evidence to convict him of that. So I've got all of that documentation. I've got that transcript from that trial, you know, that I think could be another chapter in my book. And I put the trial of the first, you know, the income tax in the book. So these things that he served 11 years of his life in jail, in prison. Now, my grandfather was the first one who was, you know, arrested for income tax evasion. Now, people don't even understand that law. When the income tax rule was first set, you know, as something that the citizens in the United States had to pay, there was a provision in that law that stated you did not have to declare any income that you earned illegally, because that would tend to incriminate yourself. You know, it's against your amendment right. But they changed it without letting people know. They did it on purpose to get Al Capone. Wow. Only purpose for that is to get Al Capone. So after went in and they sent, you know, this notice to my grandfather and my uncle, they decided to try it by first trying my grandfather for income tax evasion. They found him guilty for the same years, same amount of money as Al Capone. He got sentenced to 3 years in a federal penitentiary. A few months later, they tried Al Capone. They found him guilty and they sentenced him to 11 years. Is that fair?
No. I don't think so. No, none of it sounds fair at all.
None of it. And so, you know, he was sent to Atlanta, where he had a pretty cush thing there. I mean, he could have visitors and he was still running things and stuff like that. And there was a politician, you may remember this name. His name was J. Edgar Hoover. He wasn't a politician. He was the first head of the FBI. But when he was the head, it was not a federal. It was just the Bureau of Investigation. Well, our country was turning from a state-run kind of, you know, thing to a federal run. So it was changing into the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And the politicians weren't happy with J. Edgar Hoover because he never arrested anybody. So he made the politicians feel that, oh, well, I've got the goods on Al Capone and I'll prove it to you. So he called the first warden at Alcatraz and said, if you want to attract attention when you open up to how horrible this place is, transfer Al Capone out there. And that's exactly what they did. They whisked him. He was one day away from having new evidence in his income tax trial, where he was going back to Chicago to have a new trial. He was one day away from going back there when they put him on a train car and they sent him to Alcatraz. Now, Alcatraz doesn't have the writ of habeas corpus. They removed it during the Civil War. Lincoln did, because he didn't want prisoners to go back to the mainland and then escape. But what they did is they replaced it with time off for good behavior. Al Capone was sentenced to 11 years. He was getting out in 7. So they didn't want him to be going back, you know, into running the thing again. So my grandfather told me this story with tears running down his cheeks, that the warden called my grandfather and said, they've got a new treatment for syphilis and we would like to try it on your brother. And my grandfather agreed. So they took my uncle out of Alcatraz and they put him on Terminal Island, which is the hospital just off of Los Angeles. It's there that they started treating him for syphilis. And that's the only time, if you look at any accounts, you find that he was very angry and they had to put him in the hole for a while because they were treating him with injections of mercury. If you read Alice in Wonderland, you know there was a person in there called the Mad Hatter, and he would make the headdresses for royalty and he would dip the threads in mercury. And of course it would prick his finger and the mercury would get into his blood system. And he would go start raving mad. That's what was happening. Now, Al Capone got out of prison in November of 1939. He was supposed to be my godfather. And my grandfather had a big party for him, you know, when he got out. And my mother was pregnant with me at the time. Of course, she was there. And my mother told me, Al kept going up to me saying, who are you? And he would go to his own sister saying, who are you? And my grandfather knew something was wrong. So he made a call and found a psychiatrist in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins. So my grandfather, his mother, my grandma Sita, and May, his wife, took my uncle to Johns Hopkins, where they started to treat him to leach the poison out of his body. I personally talked to the psychiatrist's wife. He had already died. And she told me in graphic terms what they had to do in the condition that my uncle was in. When my father used to take me to the Palm Island, you know, the Miami Beach home, there would be a nurse that would come to the home twice a week, and they were continuing to give him these injections to leach the poisons out of his body. So, I mean, it was just awful. And people don't know you know, these stories. My grandma, Sita, I held her hand the moment she took her last breath on this planet. And she begged me to tell the truth about the family. So that's what I'm doing. It's been a hard job because, you know, well, no, being 80 years old, I'm playing the role that men play in the family. You know, when a woman gets married, she takes her husband's last name. The children are born with the husband's last name. The family, you know, burial plot is in the husband's last name. All right. So the family history usually follows the sperm. It never really follows the egg. It follows the sperm. So my father was the one earmarked to do the job that I am now doing. And of course, his life was taken from him. So I'm doing it, but it was very hard because, especially, you know, all these other people that have written books about Al Capone were upset with me because I could prove that Al Capone had nothing to do with the Valentine's Day Massacre. And they didn't like it because they built their reputations and a lot of wealth, you know, with the new angle to why Al Capone, you know, engineered that. So, you know, I just have never been a, you know, they didn't buy my book. In fact, you know, they told people not to buy my book. And my book is still selling, thanks to you, Max. Keep buying those copies.
You're welcome. I know what everyone's getting for Christmas now.
Well, we're very happy you wrote this book. Yeah. And I have to say, I had all those perceptions about Al Capone, you know, the Robert De Niro with the baseball bat on the Untouchables, all that stuff. Yeah. And I guarantee anyone that reads this book, if they're opinions are going to be changed reading this book. And I really applaud you. It had to take a ton of courage to do that.
It does, you know, and I got a couple of mantras, you know. One was Al Capone a mobster? Yes, he was. Was Al Capone a monster? No, he wasn't. And another one I try to say is, you know, people are entitled to their own opinion. No problem with their opinion, but not their own facts. And that's what these people did, is they made up facts so that they could come out and they've got the latest scoop. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear a lot of that in the papers and on television today. Anyway, people make up their own facts. You're entitled to your own opinion. Just let people know, in my opinion, this is how it was, rather than, no, I've got the proof. So I had to work against that, you know, to try to, you know, at least I can't change history. There's no way that I can change history. But I wanted to do something where people could at least do their own research and then make up their own minds. Usually every fall, I get maybe 4, 5, 6 requests from students to interview me. And that's about the time that they start studying Al Capone in school. So I do Zoom meetings with them and I do all kinds of things. And, you know, their parents are so happy and the kids are so happy too, you know, that at least there's a chance for them to meet somebody. You know, my husband and I just celebrated our wedding anniversary last week. We've been married 57 years.
Oh,
I have 4 children. We have 14 grandchildren. We've got 4 great grandchildren. I mean, there's some good history there, you know. So it's like, you know, if there's bad genes, I don't see them.
No, I agree with you. And I think I heard you in an interview before saying maybe a speeding ticket in our family or something like that. No criminal history and all these kids.
No, that it's, you know, really, you know, she begged me, my grandma Cedar begged me to let them know that we're not this horrible family. So, you know, I made a promise to her, and hopefully when I, you know, get called home by my God up there, she'll be there and she'll give me a big hug and a squeeze. They always squeezed my cheek. Oh, hard squeezes.
I loved in the book hearing about your grandma Sita.
Yeah.
And well, you go ahead and ask a question. I think you're wanting to ask.
I have a dozen questions, but they're probably just be personal questions. She was actually, out of every member of the family you talked about, she was my favorite. I was like, I wanted to learn more about her.
You know, Al was her favorite. He was her first child that was conceived and born in America. She and her husband went through a lot of trouble to come to America because there was promise there. At the time that they left Italy, it was, you either had to be a member of the church or the Camorra to achieve anything, all right? So they came here, and Al Capone became her American dream. Now you're gonna, you see everywhere that Al Capone was kicked out of school in sixth grade. That's not true. It was my grandfather that hit the teacher. He was kicked out of school in sixth grade. Al Capone finished high school. So he had the education. He had the chance to go to Chicago and take over, you know, the business there, he was able to move his family to Chicago from Brooklyn, and they had a great house, and my grandma could grow her herbs, and there's tomatoes in that backyard, and she could have cherry trees and apple trees. I mean, it was like, you know, her dream for coming to America came true. So it was, you know, it's just something that I had to do. So I'm, ask me anything.
Well, one thing I do want to ask, how do you feel about all these, a lot of books and articles are coming out and documentaries proving that Al Capone was a good guy, that he didn't commit the massacre, that he, all this stuff, exactly what you're saying, it keeps coming out. I remember I was watching one documentary, somebody did a drive-by trying to kill him. It didn't work. But a civilian where he was got injured, so he went right to the hospital to pay for that guy's surgery, stuff like that. So how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel very good, you know, because more and more people are doing their own research. There is a gentleman in Chicago, a great researcher and author called Jonathan Eig. And he also wrote in his book that Al Capone had nothing to do with the Valentine's Day Massacre. And there was a lot of other things that he wanted to put in the book that proved me right, but his publisher wouldn't let him because he thought the book wouldn't sell.
Oh my
gosh. So, you know, they put things in movies because it will sell tickets. They put things, you know, in books because it will sell copies. So, you know, it's a shame, but it's all based on how much money they can make doing things. So I'm very happy that more and more people are coming out and saying these kinds of things because it is the truth. I mean, he stood trial for income tax evasion, and if there was anything that they had that they could accuse him of murder or of doing any of these things, believe me, it would have come up during that trial. And it didn't. They couldn't do anything else except get him on income tax evasion. That's it.
Yeah,
people got into that business, they knew what, you know, the rules were. Mm-hmm. And if they, I mean, there was somebody that worked for Al that took some money to hit him, you know, to kill him. I mean, he worked for Al and he was going to poison him, you know? So, I mean, don't you think there should be some, you know, punishment for that?
Well, it's either you or me, yeah, and it's not going to be me. Exactly. No one's
going to be like that.
You're dealing with the rules of a different world. It's,
yeah.
Yeah, I can't watch any, this is personal, but I can't watch anything about Al because I read your book. I'm like, they're going to take this in the wrong direction? Yep, because I remember reading your book and other books that he seemed like a very, very smart guy. Obviously, he had an empire, and he was smart enough to know that it's better to get along. Well, that's that very famous quote of his. It's easier to get along with a smile and then a smile and a gun. I'm going to butcher that quote. I'm sorry. You probably know it better than me. But just that he was a happy, kind person. He only did these things when he absolutely had to.
Well, he never carried a gun. He always had bodyguards. Because he was a terrible shot. He was horrible. Couldn't get anything, you know? So he never, ever carried a gun. He always had bodyguards that had guns. So when, you know, he was put into Philadelphia prison for having a firearm, it was planted on him. They just wanted him out of circulation for a while.
So why do you think he was public enemy number one? What was it about him? And why were they so determined to get him?
All right, number one, the public enemy number one was by the Chicago Crime Commission. It was not statewide. So he was public enemy number one. My grandfather was public enemy number three for the Chicago Crime Commission. So what chance did I have? They did it because there was a group of businessmen in Chicago. They call them the Secret Six. And Chicago was going to be the home of the World's Fair, all right? People, dignitaries from all over the world were calling Chicago, and they wanted to make sure that they could meet Al Capone and Ralph Capone when they came to the World's Fair. And these businessmen didn't like that. They wanted people to come in and see the stockyards. They wanted people to come in and see the steel mills, you know, all that kind of stuff. Not meet Al and Ralph Capone. So they wanted them out of town for the World's Fair. That's what it all boiled down to.
That's crazy. Yeah. I think it is believable because you just hear about crazy stories, but it's...
Yeah. It's sad is actually. It's very, very sad.
That is crazy. I remember, because like I said, I read about this, it's for the show, and that there were so many more worse people running around back then who were in organized crime that were doing way worse things. Boardwalk Empire brought this back a little bit. I don't know if you've seen that show.
Yeah.
I couldn't watch it after.
That was based on the true incident.
Really?
That was the incident that I was telling you about. A group of politicians got together and said they wanted prohibition to end. And in order to end prohibition, they needed a constitutional amendment to end it. It took a constitutional amendment to start it, and they needed a constitutional amendment to stop it. So they needed votes. So they got the group of racketeers or mobsters together in Atlantic City, and they asked them all to quiet the noise. And they said, whoever does the best job can have the first legal distribution of alcohol, the first license to legally distribute alcohol. Well, Al Capone would be the only one. I mean, my grandfather told me at one time, because my grandfather ran the operation, all right? He said, I was running over 300 different businesses. Now just think of that. He didn't have a computer. He didn't have a fax machine. You know, I mean, he didn't have the internet, you know, cell phone, anything. And it all ran. Bills were paid. You know, the people were paid, you know, for doing their work. Everything ran well. Also, what people don't realize, no bootlegger could have been in business more than 2 days without the cooperation of the police and the politicians, all right? So you needed to play the political game. I mean, I used to be at Al's house, and my grandmother was there, and the doorbell would ring, and she would go, and there'd be two policemen standing there, and she said, just a minute. And she would go to her secret room, I'd follow her, and she'd reach up on the shelf and she'd get some money, some cash, put it into an envelope, and then take it out and give it to him. So they would leave food during, you know, the famine and stuff. the Capones would leave boxes of food on the back steps of the police stations. And I mean, they would give, you know, policemen money, and that's how their kids went to school, you know, and how they bought food and stuff. They also played the political game. If somebody wanted somebody elected, they would go and tell Al Capone to help them.
Wow.
And he would get the vote for them. People don't realize that. It was all a network. And that's why it went so well. And that story has never been told.
That's my favorite parts about reading about Prohibition and your book specifically, is how protected everyone was by these politicians and how hand in hand they were. And they would, I remember there was reading one thing where they would just, one politician, made all of his money from bribes. That's all he did. I can't remember his name now. Of course, I should have written it down for the interview.
There's probably more than one.
More than one, yeah.
Well, Jack Kennedy, I mean, you know, old man Kennedy was a big bootlegger, big. You know, and people don't realize Prohibition was very unpopular. You know, our American heritage, our history, revolves around alcohol. When the ships came over from the old country, they were loaded with alcohol. And, you know, at the end of the First World War, and that was a very, very bloody war, the Germans were immigrating to this country, and they were bringing their spirit-making, wine-making, beer-making talents with them. And the politicians and certain, you know, high-up people didn't like that because, you know, they hated the Germans because of the war. So they didn't want the Germans to be successful. So they worked to... Hold on a minute. Take that. My husband's brother. anyway, they didn't want, you know, where was I? The politicians didn't, the people didn't want Prohibition, all right? People were you know, toasting people. I mean, you go out to dinner and you toast each other at your table, you toast a bride and groom. You know, I mean, alcohol was a very big part of our heritage. Now, if you look at the Prohibition law, it did not prohibit the drinking of it or the owning of it. It only prohibited the transportation and the making of it. That's all. You could still drink it. So that's why these establishments opened up and they're called speakeasies, all right? Because you would go in there and you would speak slowly or very, you know, silently about what you wanted to drink. And they would give it to you in a coffee cup. You know, so, I mean, but think, this was in the 20s, and just think of the things that are going on in the 20s. They called them the Roaring 20s for a reason, all right? You know, women were bobbing their hair and shortening their skirts. Jazz was coming into being, you know, and jazz was so popular because all of these immigrants, you know, were coming in from all these other countries and they couldn't speak to each other. So these guys would take up instruments and they would start to play and they could all play the same tune, even though they didn't understand each other's languages.
That is wonderful. Very cool thing. Speaking of music, can you touch on how Al gave some musicians perhaps a start or a break when nobody else would?
There was a place in Brooklyn called the all of a sudden I was thinking of something else. Cotton Club. You've heard of the Cotton Club? Okay. Well, my grandfather opened up the same kind of thing in Cicero and called it the Cotton Club. And he wanted to give Black musicians their start. Now, the difference between having it in Brooklyn and having it in Chicago and Cicero was Brooklyn had access. The Black people could come in and perform there without any trouble. In Chicago, all the Blacks were on the west side of Chicago, and they had to travel through their white neighborhoods to get to perform at Cicero. So my uncle and grandfather would take, you know, a car with bodyguards in it, pick these black musicians up, take them to the club to perform, and then take them back home again. So when I was a young girl, there was a place in Chicago, you might remember this, Patty, called, what's the name of that street where all the jazz clubs were? I can't think right now. Anyway, there was a place there called the Chez Paris. And my grandfather took me there. He was in Chicago and he took me out to dinner. And we went and Nat King Cole was performing. So I got a chance, I sat right next to him. And then afterwards, my grandfather took me backstage to meet him in person. And Nat King Cole looked right at me. And he says, I want you to know, I would not have the career I have without your grandfather. So, I mean, that happened with a lot of black entertainers. And, you know, they had a career. So that story has never been told.
No, and that is an amazing story. That is a fabulous story. So I'm glad your book touches on so many things.
You remember Rush Street?
Yes, Rush Street. Oh, sure. Yep. We go there in college and hang out. Oh, yeah. It's still a great place.
I think it's still there, but it's a little different than it was when I was in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Chicago's such a great town.
Everyone who's everyone who listens to this and is from Chicago is going to be yelling that name. It's like, yeah, I know.
Rush Street. I couldn't think of it fast enough.
We have a couple more questions for you. What is your favorite family recipe? Because I know you have a bunch of them in the book.
Meatballs. Meatballs and lasagna. Those are the two favorite. And there's one thing you asked about a tradition in the Capone family. One tradition that I follow all the way through, you know, raising our children, is when you are at the dinner table, there can be no arguing. Mm-hmm. My grandmother Capone felt that if you argued or, you know, you're angry or whatever, your stomach would form acid and all that good food would turn into poison. There was a law that you could not, you told jokes, you know, you'd laughed, you know, all that kind of stuff, but you could not talk business. You couldn't have any negative thoughts at all while you were eating.
I think everybody should observe exactly. That.
I was about to say, I'm stealing that rule from my family.
Well, and another thing is that I refused to have a TV. Any place around where we ate, raising the children.
That's a good rule too.
Very good rule.
We talked then.
Right. We
talked. Didn't sit there with the phone.
No. We didn't have those.
Everyone eats face down with their head in their phone and not eye to eye contact and having conversation. It's a lost art, I think.
Yeah.
Do you have any questions?
I think maybe we can just end with, what is your favorite memory of both your grandfather, Ralph, and your uncle, Al?
One I put into the book, and we were on the Palm Island estate, and Al loved his pool. I mean, he loved to be in it because it was a saltwater pool. And the pool would rise and fall with the tides because it just had a grate in the one end and it went out to the bay. So, you know, you'd get in there and you'd see little fish and you'd see, you know, pieces of you know, all kinds of things in there. But anyway, we were there and my father had me and he said to his uncle, but my father was raised as a sibling. So he didn't say Uncle Al. He says, Al, yeah, I'm going to throw Deirdre in, catch her. So he threw me to Al. And of course I went underwater for a minute and he picked me up. Well, that was my first experience with saltwater. And I must have had this horrible look on my face. So he picked me up and he looked at me and he threw his head back and he's laughing hysterically. Then he looked at me again And he's laughing hysterically. And then my father starts laughing, you know, at the same time. So, you know, that is one thing. My grandfather, he taught me how to make popcorn. And I think I probably have that in the book. And I still make it, you know, that same way today. So he taught me how to make popcorn and just, you know, the different things that he would teach me. At one time, I was with him in this bar and they had this little jar of Italian peppers. They're really small, tiny peppers. And he says, "Here, Deirdre, I want you to eat this." And my goodness, was it hot, but I ate it. And he was so surprised that I didn't spit it out. And I said, "No."
Good for you. Good for you.
Yep.
So thank you so much for talking.
You're welcome, man.
Yeah, thank this you is... so much for your time. And we're just going to.
The book
Uncle Al Capone, The Untold Story from Inside His Family by Deirdre Marie Capone. And it is not only full of just fascinating stories from the period of Prohibition, but there's wonderful photographs in there. Yeah. And some exciting recipes that I'm definitely going to try. I'm definitely trying those meatballs. So you get some added bonuses with this story. So thank you.
You know, the thing that makes the meatballs different is, of course, you know, big chunks of garlic in there, but pine nuts.
Yes, I saw that. I've never made meatballs with pine nuts before. I'm going to give that a try.
I know we're eating tonight. Well, thank you so much.
You're going to have some good meatballs tonight, Max.
Max is getting meatballs.
Yes, I am. And so thank you. I can't believe I'm talking to you. This is why I've been a little nervous, is because I've admired you and your book for so long. And I'm
I'm very reachable.
Pardon me?
I'm very reachable.
Yeah. So again, please get the book because it's fantastic. And if you do want to talk to Deirdre on your podcast or interview her for your, you said you like to do interviews for schools.
Yeah. I mean, it they're just so cute. I mean, the one I started laughing because I guess I did it on, Skype, which I don't like Skype very much, but and we did it on Skype, and the minute they were able to get through to me, there's these four young kids, probably 12, 13 years old, sitting on the couch, and the minute I came up on the screen, they just started jumping up and down, yay, we can see her yet. I was like, whoa.
That is adorable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for us.
Thank you so much again.
And we'll wrap it up here. And as we always say on Wine About History, if it weren't for history, we wouldn't be here.
Bye. Absolutely. Absolutely. You've got to pay attention to learn from history. I remember reading a book, and the title of the book is, "If You Don't Know Where You've Been, How Do You Know Where You're Going?"
Exactly. All right. Well, I think we will end it there. Thank you again, Deirdre. And hopefully we'll talk to you again.
You have a great day. Yeah, that'll be one of your follow-up interviews.
I'd love to see this when you get it up and going. So just send a link. Okay. Thank you, guys. And you stay well.
Thanks.
Stay
you well. Too stay well and enjoy that Florida sunshine.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. All right. Ciao. As you say in Italy, ciao.
Ciao.